percent, 65 degrees Kenosha, 64 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. Part one features a talented local writer by the name of Nicholas Michael Ravnikar. Part two is an interview with the author of a beautiful new book called Decluttered, a perfect book for those of us who have trouble letting go of our stuff. Here's part one. I'm excited about this portion of WGTD's Morning Show and the opportunity to speak with a very gifted writer from southeastern Wisconsin, Nicholas Michael Ravnikar, former Racine writer-in-residence. He is very active in something called the Poetry Movement, which has been engaged in a number of different outreach activities, including a bus poems project or bus poems contest, which is designed to bring poetry, if you will, onto the buses, the vehicles of public transportation in the city of Racine, and in particular to help foster the creation of poetry that speaks to the very important issue of mental health, of mental and emotional well-being. And towards that end, the Poetry Movement is in collaboration with the City of Racine Transportation Department and with NAMI of Racine County with some workshops and this contest in which they hope a host of folks from here in southeastern Wisconsin will produce new poetry that can be shared with the community. We're going to talk about all of this and more over the next few minutes with Nicholas Michael Ravnikar. We welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Gregory.
Good to have you here. Before talking about all that I just very quickly summarized, tell us a little bit about where you come from originally and a little bit about your life of writing, where that began.
Sure. So I grew up mostly in Waukegan, Illinois. We moved there from La Salle, Peru, Illinois, when I was three. With my mother and my father, and left there when I was in fourth grade, came to Kenosha because it was halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee, or close enough to Waukegan where my mom was still working as a nurse and where my father up north in Milwaukee had gotten a job as an engineer. So grew up mostly around these parts, left after graduating high school, having experienced a number of mental health crises in my teens. Went down to Chicago, studied poetry at Columbia College, took some classes at the City Colleges of Chicago, came back up to Kenosha, finished my bachelor's degree at UW-Parkside, majoring in English, and then studied in a low residency program at Naropa University for a Master of Fine Arts. I was pretty heavily involved in bringing poetry workshops to after-school programs and into the Racine Youthful Offender Correctional Facility in Racine while I was doing my graduate program at Naropa, and then started adjuncting at Gateway, Parkside, what used to be Kaplan University in Milwaukee, and Carthage College, and then eventually took on a full-time lectureship at UW-Parkside for 3 years, and bounced around between a number of different employers after that, largely due to many of the same mental health concerns. And I want to say it was in 2023 that I was selected as the Racine Writer in Residence. But prior to that selection, I was also involved with starting the poetry movement with a friend of mine who I had previously gone to Columbia College with, named Ivan Ramos. He and I reconnected after a couple years apart and started trying to write transportation in our poetry together, and to use the idea of transportation between Milwaukee and Chicago, this as like, you know, the third largest economic corridor in the nation, and then the centrality of transportation in terms of our ability to get between those places and also to get with one another, to connect with one another. So we thought that transportation was a fitting metaphor. We worked on a project called Heartbreak Street that involved a poetry chapbook, as well as a number of different performances that we did throughout Chicago and Milwaukee. And after having gotten that off the ground, we began to solicit work from people for an anthology of poems that feature transportation as a central image or conceit in the poems. And from that point, we're still working to publish that, trying to get funding for it. But from that point, making the connection with Ride Racine during my writer in residency, where I was focusing on the idea of transportation, it was just sort of a natural fit to have the culminating project be an open mic showcase where we could have writers and performers from the area come into the historic transportation center in Racine and gather together for 2 hours to share with one another. So that's sort of the development of my career, my writing history into this project.
Fantastic. So as a young person in your teens, and you touched on the fact that you were experiencing some mental health issues even at that point, how important was writing for you at that point in time? And if you were writing then actively, was it any sort of a source of help for you?
I mean, I think it's always been a source of catharsis, right? That's sort of what Aristotle famously talks about, the function of theater or poetry serving for the audience who's receiving it. And I think likewise for the author who's creating it, there's a degree of emotional release that goes into writing something, even something that isn't directly confessional, right? I wouldn't say that writing necessarily saved my life, because I think that there were a lot of mental health professionals and medications and therapy sessions that really went into making that happen. But writing has definitely been one of the constant sources of support that I could turn to, and an outlet for a lot of the mental and emotional disruption that I frequently experience as a result of the different conditions that I've been diagnosed with.
Right. So have you written, in a sense, fairly consistently, rather relentlessly through the course of your life, or do you find yourself drawn back to writing at certain points?
I would say for the most part, I'm an alcoholic. I've been without a drink for 13 years, and my experience with writing and with most other things is very much like my experience with alcohol and other intoxicating substances, which is that when I am doing it, I'm all in. I mean, it's all consuming, it's unrelenting, and I can't turn it off. And at a certain point, priorities will come in and I'll sort of need to make a decision to shift away from doing that and focus on those things. So like right now, my main focus is working on this contest, promoting the contest. And to be honest, it's also pickleball. It's my latest fascination. But I don't think I've probably written one or two poems a week for the last 6 months. But that's unusual for me. Most periods in time, I'm writing three a day.
Right. And it sounds like poetry has been the primary focus of your writing exploits, is that right?
Yeah, I was a copy editor for the Kenosha News and a freelance journalist. And then obviously as an academic, there's like the writing of academic papers and reports and stuff. But poetry definitely took up the bulk of my attention as a writer.
Can you explain what the allure has been? I mean, what is it about the writing of poetry that speaks to you so directly, or maybe just gives you such pleasure and satisfaction?
Sure. So Allen Ginsberg, who was one of the founders of the Naropa Institute that became Naropa University, where I got my MFA, famously talked about the misunderstanding of prophecy, the idea that prophecy is someone foretelling the future. Certainly is one viable or plausible understanding of it, but the other one is that an author or speaker who's able to put down or put into words something that generates an image that someone else later in time can experience and have a resonating emotional experience with. I think at a very young age, you know, reading William Blake or Allen Ginsberg or Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Sappho, Homer, and having these transcendent experiences where, you know, you're transported into flights of the imagination, for me was something that transported me from the oftentimes overwhelming social and or interpersonal situations that I found myself in. And I wanted to do the same thing for other people.
You want to give other people the same pleasure that you've experienced yourself.
I mean, T.S. Eliot talks about the unburdening of the personality, right? Like somebody who has like too much personality really gets and appreciates how important it is to be alleviated of the burdens of of a personality.
And of all that's inside you.
Yeah,
and all that you're carrying around.
Right.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nicholas Michael Ravnikar, former Racine writer in residence and one of the guiding lights, guiding forces of the poetry movement, which is, can we call it an organization?
It's a movement.
It's a
yeah,
movement.
We can call it an
It's an undertaking,
sure.
Seeking to bring poetry into more and more people's lives, particularly in the Racine community, and particularly around issues involving mental well-being, mental health, mental illness, and one of the ways of doing that is the possibility of bringing of encouraging more and more people to write their own poetry and share it, and for some of that to actually be visible in the vehicles of Racine's public transportation system, which is such an interesting idea. So tell us very specifically about this bus poems contest. How is it sort of laid out? Who is eligible to participate, and what it's all about?
So the end goal is to get poems on all of the buses in the city of Racine. And I know that it's at least 34. I think it might be 35 buses that they have that are running at any given time, and a few more than that that are in reserve. So we want to get at least one poem on every bus inside every bus in the city of Racine's fleet. And of necessity, those have to be smaller poems because we only have an 11 by 17 signage to put it on. So we decided that it would be advisable for us to, or ideal for us to have something short. 25 syllables was what I came up with because it's going to be 2025.
Ah.
So we can sort of commemorate the year. It'll be January when the signs get installed. So and they'll be on the bus for the whole year. So 25 syllables for 2025. And I really wanted the whole project to somehow highlight mental health in Racine. So that's another component or requirement that we've got for the project, which is that 25-syllable poem that deals in some way with mental health in Racine. And that, very loosely construed, I mean, you know, describe a place where you feel something, and you've got a poem about mental health.
Right, right. I was glad to see that in the news release. You go into some detail about that, the fact that it can be as something as simple as a poem about your own well-being and something that just makes you feel happy or just makes you feel at peace. Or certainly it can be a poem about something that frightens you or disturbs you or troubles you.
Absolutely. And I would even say, you know, I was thinking about this on the way here, right? Like any sort of pro-social activity. So if somebody's out, you know, sitting in the bleachers watching their kid play Little League or, you know, whatever it is that they experience, they're at the park and they see somebody else walking their dog. I mean, that can be a moment in which they recognize an emotion that they're experiencing or an emotion that someone else might be experiencing or the mental health benefits of engaging in a particular activity. So it's really very broad.
I love that. So when did you first issue this invitation?
Yeah, so we announced it at our July 26th open mic showcase. It was when we formally announced that the contest was open, and submissions are accepted until October 1st. The idea came about after the January 2024 showcase, because the two of the board members of Art Root, which was the organization that funded and supported the Writer in Residence project, Rob Osborne and Vera Skekic, they expressed a really keen desire for more activity at the Transit Center, and also Trevor Young, who the director of transportation for the city of Racine, who had allowed us to use the space there at the Corinne Reed Owens Transportation Center, said that he'd be open to more collaboration. So for me, it all just kind of came together right around February or March of 24.
Fantastic. Tell us about the writing workshops that have already taken place, and there is a further one that's happening this Thursday, the 12th of September. Tell us the purpose of them and how the previous workshops have gone.
Sure. So the initial workshop that we had was actually in June, and that was geared toward performance dynamics mostly. Mm. We did write some pieces. There were about five folks who came to the Racine Literacy Council for that event. And I also did give them sort of a heads up about, you know, hey, we're going to have this contest. I didn't really unveil all of the details, but said, there's going to be this contest, and, you know, if you want to come to the open mic, I'll be announcing all the details there. And so we had that workshop, and then the 26th of July was our open mic showcase. And then just a few weeks ago, on the 18th of August, we had a workshop over at the Literacy Council, and sparsely attended, but we basically went through a series of short form poems or short poetry forms. So the haiku, the loon, we looked at the couplet. There were a couple other forms that we examined, and I had written a few examples, and in a few cases had taken some examples that are out there in the public domain, and we examined those and then thought about how we could take the 25 syllables and divide them up in some way, or what formal constraints we could create for ourselves. And then we concluded that workshop by looking at some revision techniques that I've frequently taught when I was a professor, and also that I use as a copy editor to really strive for brevity and clarity in writing. So it basically involves eliminating adjectives and adverbs, turning them into nouns and verbs, moving toward the active voice, away from the passive voice, trying to say things in as few words as possible. And so I find that for a lot of people who approach poetry and creative writing, and maybe writing in general, they think, you know, the more words, the better, the bigger words, the better. And so I'm, you know, really try to emphasize, like, strive for an image, strive to convey the image in as few words as possible. And then once you've got that, then work on the poeticizing piece of it.
Right. Very good. What's the plan for this Thursday, September 12th?
Same deal. Okay. We're going to focus on some short poetic forms, read some examples so that people can see how economy of language works in a very short form. And then we'll discuss some different ways to organize it. And then they'll revise the initial piece that they write at the beginning of the workshop.
Excellent. One thing that intrigues me is that the Bus Poems project obviously involves poems that will be taken in visually. But a lot of the events you've had have been open mics where poetry is heard. That's one of the things I just find very striking about poetry in general, is that it is taken in both ways. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that there are some poems that are meant to be read, that is, not read aloud so much as read with your eyes and reread and reread and so on, versus other poems that where really to fully experience them, you should hear it read aloud. I wonder if you're struck by that interesting duality in the world of poetry. And there's probably plenty of poems that are interesting in both mediums.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think visual poetry has become more and more front and center. There's even a strain of poetry, I would call it experimental writing, called acemic writing or acemic poetry, which is, I don't know if this is going to make sense to anybody, it is writing without words. So it'll be scrawling, basically, in different, you know, if I were to just speak nonsense,
Okay.
Or a sort of Jabberwocky language, right?
So it's the poetic
the written equivalent of that. Okay. Yeah. So the tension between the written and the spoken is definitely something that I think writers have been very aware of for quite a while. I mean, you know, our earliest poetry was oral poetry. But at the same time, some of our earliest art was cave art that was visually represented on the wall. And so there's certainly a connection and a correspondence there between what we're saying and how we're saying it, whether that's in writing or whether that's via spoken language.
Right. So this Bus Poems project and the contest, the deadline of which is, again,
October 1st.
What is your hope for the most significant benefit of that? I mean, what do you see as the greatest good that would come from that?
Sure. Well, the greatest good. Am I supposed to say justice or virtue? The greatest. Yeah, I mean, I think that is kind of it, right? Like, I think the greatest benefit that could come from it would be that somebody who doesn't write poetry at all is spurred to write something.
Mm.
Or somebody who does write poetry finds an audience for, you know, or a venue for themselves to send in the poems that they write. I think trying to create more spaces where poetry is published, read, seen, appreciated is really like the big goal. And so maybe I'll also say, maybe the greatest good is also somebody on the bus looking up at, you know, that moment when they're having a difficult time or they're experiencing some sort of big emotion that they're not sure how to deal with, and they see a poem that just happens to resonate with that particular experience that they're having. I mean,
wow.
That would be the sine qua non of, you know, what I would hope for.
That would be great. Would be great. By the way, I did want to ask you for just a minute or two about the work you did with the Youthful Offender Program. So that was a writing program of some sort. In what way was writing used in the lives of these young people?
Yeah, so, and you're taking me way back now. this would have been 2007. And I got a grant from the Wisconsin Arts Board and support from the Racine Arts Council. Lorna Hennig was then the director of it. And she had already been bringing visual art once a week into the Racine Youthful Offender Correctional Facility with another Racine artist, Jerry Belland. And so I had found out about that. And I'd brought poetry workshops into various Chicago public schools when I was teaching there. So I had an interest in, teaching poetry workshops, leading poetry workshops, facilitating them. And I was fresh out of my undergrad, and there was this opportunity to get a grant. So I wrote it, and I think it was 15 weeks. I went in once a week. I got, you know, notebooks and copies and writing utensils for them, and they wrote poems, and then we went through a selection process and a revision process and a selection process, and then I put together a brief collection of their work, and then we released that. We had a release reading at a cafe that is no longer in existence in Racine, where Nick Dembski, another poet who lives in Racine,
yes,
and I read the poems. And that was that.
Wow.
Yeah. So we were able, it was good. The project was called Unjailed Voice. So we were able to get them to write their experiences and bring them out into the community and, you know, read their words.
Yeah. Well, this seems like it could be a similar sort of venture in the sense of giving voice to maybe certain people who've felt as though they were largely without a voice and largely unheard.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely trying my best to get the promotions out as widely as I can to all of the community centers in the city of Racine. I'm also going to be going out this week and next week to get them into more restaurants. I tried to get them into a few, you know, downtown West Racine, uptown businesses already, but, you know, more certainly wouldn't hurt.
Right. If people are interested in participating in the contest and or getting more information about every aspect of the poetry movement, is there a website they can visit or somewhere they can call?
Yeah, we are at I don't even know if people say www anymore. But
sometimes.
Okay. But, we are at thepoetrymovement.org.
Very good. Should be easy to find. And Nicholas Michael Ravnikar, I appreciate all that you're doing, applaud these efforts, and we hope that a lot of people are going to avail themselves of this opportunity to fashion some original poetry and enter it in this bus poems contest with the possibility of their poetry being seen by a whole lot of people on Racine public transportation. What a fantastic idea.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss it more. I do want to say that we do have $600 in funding right now for the winners. We're not quite sure how that's going to break down in terms of how it's distributed. So
okay.
The judges will, based on the number of poems we ultimately receive, decide whether they want to, you know, accord that to just a few top winners or spread it out amongst everybody. So there is some prize money as well available for people who submit and are selected.
Very good. Doesn't hurt. Very good. Nicholas Michael Ravnikar, thank you for being my guest in this portion of the Morning Show today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, the next few minutes are going to be spent talking about something that I know is a very significant concern in my life and in many aspects of my life, and I suspect many of you as well are struggling to deal with the clutter in your lives. And not just the clutter in terms of what's on the floor or filling up the attic or filling up the basement, but also the way in which our very lives and our minds can also be cluttered. I have been enjoying and benefiting already from a brand new book called Decluttered, Mindful Organizing for Health, Home, and Beyond. The author of the book, Jenny Albertini, actually left a well-paying, high-profile job in the healthcare industry, if you will, in order to become a professional health organizer, training under the internationally acclaimed Marie Kondo, and became a consultant, and has gone on to do a great deal of work in this way. And her new book outlines all kinds of different ways in which one can think about the stuff in one's life and what is most important to us and the kind of life that we want to live. The book is published by Red Lightning Books, and I'm excited to be able to speak with its author for the next few minutes. The book, again, is Decluttered. And Jenny Albertini, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
So as you outline in the introduction to the book, you had a very, very busy professional life, but decided to step away from it and essentially resign from a very well-paying full-time job in order to pursue this possibility of becoming a personal professional organizer. One of the things you tell us is that as you embarked on that, a mistake you made, I guess might be a way to say it, is that you sort of closed the door on what you had been doing in a way that probably was counterproductive, that in fact a lot of the work that you were doing was going to ultimately be very helpful in this new adventure. Tell us just a little more about what you were doing and the way in which what you were doing professionally has actually informed the work you're doing now as a professional organizer.
Sure thing. So what I had been doing, Greg, is I had been working on global public health programs for the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. State Department, U.S. Agency for International Development, mostly based in Africa. And I had been working on HIV programs, women's health programs over the years in many countries. And I really loved that work. But I think like many people, after a couple of decades of doing the same thing in a very high stressful situation, I just wasn't feeling like it was the right path for me anymore. And so in 2016, when Marie Kondo announced that she was going to start training people in her decluttering and organizing method, I shot my hand up because that was something after having read her book, I realized I really loved her method. It was something I liked helping my colleagues do and everything. And so I said, oh, forget this public health work. Let me go and do this, help people declutter their things. That will really solve the burnout that I had been experiencing in my career. But what I learned in that mistake that you referenced is that so much of what I had been doing in my public health career was helping people figure out the underlying reasons why there were health problems in their life and what to do about them and how to help empower them, asking the right questions to get them to figure out what were the next right steps for them. And after a little while of working in my professional organizing job, I realized, oh, I need to be asking these same types of questions to my clients around the clutter in their homes, the clutter in their offices, even the clutter in their computers. And that's really going to help us all figure out what's the true path towards decluttering and organizing our lives. So I feel really thankful I could bring back some of my first career steps and experience into this current career that I have.
You began this new venture before the COVID-19 pandemic. And one of the things you talk about in your book is the way in which that pandemic, of course, changed you, affected you, but also changed and affected a whole lot of people in this particular area. I mean, that is when it came to one's home, own home, and how you function in the home and what is most important and what should be discarded and so on. What would you say are the most significant ways in which COVID was a very significant factor in this particular arena?
Well, one way, of course, is once we were all confined to our homes, we were forced to leave behind the busyness, the running away from the stuff that surrounds us. I think I live in Washington, D.C. This is a city where people are out and about and doing things all the time. And so if you've got a lot of messes at home, you can just ignore them, Greg. You are going to be out and doing lots of things. But when you're forced at home to really confront, let's say, your shopping habits that are constantly bringing more things into your home, maybe piles up of paper that you never got to, or sentimental items. So you are really forced to visually see this and then take stock of how it was making you feel. And then another way that the COVID pandemic really enlightened people to what clutter was doing in our lives is it forced us to say, what is important now? You know, is our health the most important thing? Are our relationships the most important thing? So many people were separated from their loved ones for so long. And I think really got the sentiment that, oh, spending time with people who are important to me is what I miss and what I value. And maybe it's not the things that I'm buying or spending money on or spending time taking care of. And so, you know, although obviously there were horrific consequences of that pandemic, those are just two ways I can offer as to how people started thinking about the stuff and the clutter in their lives more deeply.
We're speaking with Jenny Albertini about her new book, Decluttered, Mindful Organizing for Health, Home, and Beyond. So you say decluttering is about so much more than getting rid of things. When we make purposeful choices about what we want to live with, we also set intentions for how we want to live. Let's take apart two words in that turn of phrase or those couple of sentences. Purposeful choices. We all make choices all the time. What's the difference between a normal choice, if you will, versus purposeful choices? And how significant is that in terms of one decluttering one's life?
I think when I hear you say normal choices, Greg, I might rephrase that to be a responsive choice. You know, that's the type of choice that says, oh, we're running low on paper towels, so let me log on to Amazon and order a case of that quite right away. That's a response. That's an immediate thing. A purposeful choice might say, oh, I've noticed that we're running low on paper towels in the kitchen. Let me go downstairs to the basement, double check, see whether I have any back stock still available. Oh, I do still have two rolls around. So I'm going to wait. I'm going to pause before I just go ahead and rush order something else. And that's just, of course, you know, one example of that. But what I try to encourage people to do a lot around making these different purposeful choices about what we're buying, what we're consuming, is really taking that pause and thinking about, A, do I need this right now? B, can I think of the best way to get the item that I really want into my house? And what's, you know, how does that factor into my shopping habits, my spending habits, and things like that? And we really want to sort of encourage people to be as mindful about choices that we're making, because it has a strong impact on our financial resources and also the time that we're spending buying and using and taking care of the things around our house. That I, in my, you know, work and with clients all over the world, has really shown that we're buying and we're bringing in too many things to our homes, and we're then having to spend a lot of time taking care of it. Whereas if we'd been a little bit more mindful and sort of waited and sort of before buying and bringing in more things, we'd have a better sense of what we really wanted and needed at any given time.
One of the things you tell us about is that the term clutter can be used in a couple of very important ways. And although your book is, of course, quite a lot about the clutter of stuff, of physical things that, of course, we hear so much about, but you also spend some time talking about what at one point you call the clutter of ideas. And you even go so far as to say the clutter of ideas cause some of the greatest challenges for people I work with. Just explain this notion of the clutter of ideas and why it is such a serious issue in the lives of so many people you work with.
So the clutter of ideas really came up for me when I started working with people who were bringing up all of the someday maybes they were going to do. I'd like to say, Greg, it was, oh, I've saved all these tabs on my phone because they're showing me articles I want to post on LinkedIn. They're people I want to contact for that research study that I'm going to do. It's the stuff, Greg, that is taking up our brain space. And that is, you know, there's twofold of an issue there. There's the fact that, well, that's actually a lot of digital space, if we're talking about clutter and tabs on our phones, or it's people printing out lots of things they see on the internet that, oh, that's an exercise I want to try. Oh, those are recipes I want to try. They're really become this overwhelming pile of things that we aspire to do, that we want to do. And one of the issues is that it's getting in the way of us deciding on any given day, what is it that we're actually going to do? Because if you have a pile in front of you of all the things you could do, what that has led to for many of us is an overwhelm. It really stops us from getting started because we think and we fall into very often a perfectionist trap of, well, I can't start any of these items until I figure out which is the best one. I've printed out 4 different recipes for a pie to make, but I'm not quite sure which to go with because I'm overwhelmed by choice. And this is something that has become such a challenge over the last decade or so, as social media and our attention span economy has really led us to being able to see options for everything. There's a never-ending supply of things that we could be doing. When I talk about the clutter ideas in my book, I want people to know that they're not alone if that's something that they're suffering from. And one of the things I recommend is taking a pause and taking stock of, what are these ideas telling you? Where is your attention leaning one way or the other? And can we try and group these things, you know, and organize, so to speak, for this inanimate objects very often, in a way that allows you to take purposeful, slow, steady action towards deciding what you're going to do and then implementing that action.
One of my favorite phrases in the book is when you explain to the reader, I will be asking you to go slower and look deeper. And I think you're saying that in contrast to the way in which a lot of us in urgent need of decluttering sort of think about it as a frantic, mad dash around the house. And you really invite us to think about it in a more thoughtful way. I want to just bring up something brief from my own family's history. Both my father and my grandfather both happened to be pastors. And when my grandfather retired and actually left his home, his sister, whom he lived with, kind of made a quick decision to sell off essentially all of his books, much to my father's horror. And I remember my father saying, "You can't do that because a pastor's books are like a carpenter's tools. And even when somebody is maybe no longer an active carpenter, you still don't necessarily immediately discard all of those tools. I mean, you can, and some might choose to, but one should understand the emotional cost of that." And that phrase has really stayed with me, although maybe sometimes to my detriment. But I wonder if you could just say a word about when we have an emotional attachment to certain things, because they are, in a sense, attached to our identity. And does that complicate all this too much, or is that worthy of consideration when one thinks about something like decluttering one's life?
Well, I think it's both, Greg. I think it complicates and is worthy of attention and consideration. You know, I hear a story like you just shared, and I imagine the trauma that your dad must have felt when he saw these books gone. And if I had to guess, if it's anything like other clients I've worked with, that probably, in, you know, led to perhaps him having a strong attachment to things around him and being unwilling to let go. Very often, ways that we see our family members either hold on to things, you know, whether it's hoarding behavior or just a strong attachment to things, or have that like rapid decluttering like your aunt, it sounds like, experience, like that really shapes how we feel about things and how often and how long we should be holding on to them. And I really try not to pass judgment with my clients or the readers from my book about what your feeling is. What I encourage people to do is to ask why these are coming up. Why do you or your father have these attachments to the books? Is that how you want to live? Is that, are there certain amounts or certain types of books perhaps that are most important to keep that maybe represent the memory that is important of your grandfather, of the lineage that you have, and really try and dissect with people so that they can decide ultimately what is the volume that feels right to them of any given things. Because even when people say, I can't get rid of any books because they represent, you know, the profession of my family members, I might try and take a deeper look and say, is the volume of what you have overwhelming who you are now, or actions that you want to take, or just the maintenance of your home? And is that what your family members would want? You know, so it's really a dance back and forth between honoring who we've been, what, you know, our lineage has brought us, and who we are now and what our reality is, and what we're able to take care of and maintain in an orderly fashion.
I know we're past time. Could I ask you one more question?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm speaking with Jenny Albertini, talking about her book, Decluttered: Mindful Organizing for Health, Home, and Beyond. I appreciate so much that you say in this book, but one of them in particular that I found really fascinating is the idea that one of the harms of clutter is that, in a sense, it can remove beauty from our home. And I guess the way you say it is, clutter can manifest itself not just as piles of things, I mean, that's almost always how we think of it, but as an absence of beauty or art.
Yeah.
I'd never stopped to think about that, but yes, it's really true. When one, of course, can't help but watch one of those programs on television where people go into the home of a hoarder, usually we're just, in a sense, horrified and captivated by the mountains of stuff that's there. But one of the things we end up not even maybe realizing in the moment is that there won't be anything really beautiful there. Either nothing is on the walls, or whatever is on the walls is completely obscured. Or even if someone has accumulated all kinds of beautiful things, there's a point at which the beauty sort of vanishes in kind of a blur. And I'd never really stopped to think about that. And I thought that was such a fascinating way to look at it. And I'm intrigued that you know, with your own background, I'm not sure anything in your background specifically points to that as a public health concern, which is what guides a lot of the way you think about this. But I wonder how that first occurred to you, this absence of beauty as being one of the costs of clutter.
Oh, thanks so much, Craig. I'm really touched that you noticed that part. And the one of the ways that came to me is I've been studying over the last few years neuroaesthetics, which is the study of what's really happening to our brains when we experience art. And that can be, an experience can mean when you're doing something like singing or dancing or painting, but it also can mean just when you're visually watching something, like you're looking at a painting on your wall, or you're enjoying listening to music in your home. And this interest came about because the more, well, I do have a background in art from way back when, and it's a, you know, personal interest of mine. But what I was seeing with my clients very often is there's so much shame around having clutter in your home, from small amounts to large amounts, that so many people, when they're dealing with that, are preventing themselves from putting up the paintings that they like, the pictures that are important to them, from enjoying their home and turning on music when they're cooking dinner and things like that. And they would always say to me, oh, Jenny, I'll put that art up once I feel like my clutter is under control, once I feel like I'm proud of my home and will be having people come over. But in the study, what I've realized is that actually, if we go ahead and put that art on our walls, if we turn that music on, it inspires us, Greg. It makes us feel better. And when we feel better, we are more apt to do things like finish decluttering a pile of clothes on the floor. Put away the papers that have been on the landing steps for quite a while. And so what we're looking for is always like these wins of dopamine, right? Because that's what propels us to keep doing the things that will make us feel good. And that can be honestly as simple as making sure you've hung up the artwork in your home that you enjoy looking at. And that's what I, you know, aspire and hope everyone will get and be able to do in their homes. If we enjoy living in our spaces, we are more likely to be able to maintain clutter and order, which ultimately makes us feel better, Greg, and allows us to do the things that we really want to do with our lives every day.
I like that very much. And I like the part about trying to keep shame and stigma and all of those sort of darker feelings and forces at bay. At one point you say one of your goals is to get people to remove the internalized should statements from the vocabulary of your clients. There really does need to be joy in even as daunting a task as decluttering one's life, one's home, one's workplace, and so on. Well, you explore all of that and so much more so thoughtfully in your new book called Decluttered: Mindful Organizing for Health, Home, and Beyond, published by Red Lightning Books. And it's a beautiful book not only to read, but just to look at visually as well. Jenny Albertini, thank you so much for giving the world this book and for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful read.
Tomorrow on the morning show, the search for new Poets Laureate for both Racine and Kenosha, and from the archives, a conversation with the last survivor pulled out of the rubble of Ground Zero alive back on 9/11. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sunny skies today and a high of 83 degrees, partly cloudy overnight and cool, a low of 55. Sunny tomorrow as we warm to a high of 86 degrees, 85 for a high on Thursday. More moderate conditions expected over the weekend, and also over the weekend, a modest chance of rain. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. WPR.